Hello and welcome back to the Greater Greener Georgia podcast, where we discuss the science behind climate change and the solutions driving us toward a cleaner, more sustainable future. I am so proud to be joined today by Huffington Foundation Professor of Economics and Environmental Studies at Wesleyan University, Dr. Gary Yeo. Welcome to the show, Gary.
Thank you. Thank you for having me and thank you for finding me. I'm very excited to be here. Congratulations on Tuesday.
Thank you. Yes, we are sailing off of this amazing win here in Georgia and really across the nation. So, we're looking forward to having some climate champions in office. The work you do is so interesting. I was doing a little research on you and just reviewing your background in economics and then the shift to environmental studies. I find that so interesting and I want to know how you got there. So why don't you start by giving us a little bit of insight into your background and how you started doing this work?
Sure. I went to University of Pennsylvania, majored in four or five different things, finally did mathematics. That got me into a PhD program in economics at Yale. I knew the math, didn't know anything about economics, but came out of Yale being a sort of microeconomic theorist worrying about decision-making under uncertainty. And I was pretty good at it. I was doing well and very happy with that, writing papers for people like me and hardly anybody else. My wife and I moved to Connecticut, just up the road from Yale. And in 1981, Bill Nordhaus phoned me up. He was a dissertation advisor and asked if I wanted to be involved in a study for the National Academies of Science on changing climate. I told him I didn't know anything about changing climate, and he said, I don't really either, but we're trying to put together a panel who will take a first cut at what we understand and what might be driving increases in temperatures if that's to be expected for a long period of time. And it seemed like a good idea at the time, so I said yes. And 2 years later, our report came out. Bill and I created spaghetti graphs of emissions and temperature trajectories from a very simple global model. It was the first time that nobody had done that. But the panel itself had, counting me, three economists, and I think there might have been five or six economists around the world that knew anything about climate change. So we were sort of making up the approach as we went along, and it was just really good fun. It got my attention. It looked like there were an awful lot of questions to be answered about climate change, and they felt a lot like decision making under uncertainty. And so I just started to do that. I was privileged to be at a university by then, Wesleyan University, who allowed me to follow my nose. I mean, they hired me to be a theoretical economist, and I was publishing in big deal economics journals, but now all of a sudden I was doing climate science, consuming what we knew about this from the scientists and thinking about the economics of what drives climate change. We weren't even worried about what the impacts and damages were. And they let me do it. So I started to publish in big deal science journals, and that was fine with them. As long as I taught economics in my economic classes, went to department meetings and showed up at least three times a week.
That's amazing. And such an interesting connection, because again, you've often argued that climate change is as much of an as an economic issue as it is an environmental issue. So how do you explain that to folks who feel like climate change is just a scientific issue or just about human behavior?
It's not really a hard sell, because discernible influence finding from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change said human activity was, well, there's discernible evidence that human activity was affecting the climate system. What human activity? Well, it was the economic activity that was generated out of the Industrial Revolution and went through periods of really terrible regular sorts of pollution, and was evolving into something that used a lot of fossil fuel at an increasing rate. So that's economic. And then eventually, you can think of the environmentalists and climate scientists generating findings about impacts on temperature, on sea level rise, on drought frequency, on wildfire intensity and things like that. But they needed somebody to answer the so what question from outside of their community. And that's where economics comes in on the other end of the causal chain. It's one of the indicators of an impact that humans should take seriously. It's not the only one. It's not just dollars and cents. It can be human lives. It could be ecosystems. It could be ice sheets that you know is going to cause problems with water supply, if not sea level rise, and things like that. So it, in the profession, it was a pretty easy mold. And in terms of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that emerged in 1991 in response to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change from 1989, the connection was pretty much made. Now, the connection down to dining room tables and small communities is a lot harder to do, but the connection that economics played a role at the beginning of the chain to the end of the chain wasn't too hard of a sell.
Now, you've talked about, I've heard you mentioned this recently, but I've heard you in other interviews mention risk and uncertainty. And I want to make sure our viewers and listeners are aware of that. So again, much of your work has focused on managing risk and uncertainty in climate policy. What lessons have you learned about how to make smart decisions when science is certain about the direction, but uncertain about the timing?
Yeah, and it's even only certain about the direction in some major categories, a very high likelihood in everywhere, but it is unequivocal that the planet is warming and humans are to blame. What I learned, economists at the very beginning approached this as a giant public goods problem, and we were pretty good with that. We had decades of literature in the economics field of public goods, the commons problem, and things like that. And it's when individual actions affect the welfare of lots and lots of people, and how do you hold those individuals responsible for their actions, pay them if it's good and ask them to pay if it's bad. We knew a lot about that. So the natural approach, and Bill took it as the first one to try, was to set up a giant optimization problem. And the problem with that is relied on a lot of information and all of the uncertainties that you talked about. You can only do one scenario at a time. You might not know much about the future, but you know that one scenario is not going to happen. So how do you go about thinking about it? And in 2007, building up to it in 2006, people at the IPCC, Steve Schneider and I and a guy named Bill Hogan, thought about it and thought it was really a risk management problem. Risk is likelihood times consequence, and we could talk about likelihood and we could talk about consequence. And that made enormous sense in it, and it incorporated the uncertainty, or at least how we could conceptualize what the uncertainty was. And we also thought responses had to be iterative, because it was silly to think that you could write global climate policy in 2007 for the entire world, for the entire century, and that it would have any chance of doing more good than harm. So that's what we wrote. It still involved costs and benefits and adaptation and mitigation and attitudes towards risk and sustainability and equity and things like that. And the optimization problems made some sense and they were informative, but really decision-making needed to look at the two components of risk and the two tools that you have, and mitigation, reducing emissions can reduce the likelihood, and adaptation, reducing the consequences, can reduce risk on the other end of the trail. And iteration means you build in mid-course corrections and you tell the people, the general public, this is what's going to happen. So that in 10 or 15 years, when you're making an adjustment, they don't say, well, you guys lied 15 years ago. Why should we trust you? No, 15 years ago, we said in about 15 years, we're going to revisit the problem. And what do you want us to do? Ignore the new information? No. What you do is take that into account and you make adjustments.
Let's make this an applicable, practical issue. It gets warmer, storms increase in intensity. And that trickles down to affecting things like our home insurance. Do you see where I'm going here? Okay, so I want you to talk just a little bit or give us a case, a scenario of how even these events are affecting like our insurance, our property.
There are a lot of examples. One of the things that a risk management approach tells you is that it's not fear-mongering to talk about the extreme events, the fires in LA and Lahaina, the droughts in the Midwest and California. California's had a drought now for 7 or 8 years. Flash floods in Asheville and Texas and things like that. Those happen and they hit individuals and people see them on the news. So that's one way of transmitting it. I have to admit though that most of us thought that if there were just one really awful event that could be attributed back to climate change on a global scale, that people would get the message and say, "Boy, geez, we really have to do something about that. We might be next. It might affect my family someplace living in the Midwest or so." It would just break the ice jam, and it didn't. It was in the news for a while, and we've finally given up on the idea that one big event is going to be a tipping point, going to change the world. So now what happens? Well, you go to the opposite extreme, which is to get people to recognize climate changes in their environment, out their kitchen window, in their towns, in their communities, in their state, and think, gee, we need to take care of that, and that gets their attention to adaptation, but it's not a big leap to say, well, we also should be doing our part to try to reduce emissions, and the benefits for that will expand well beyond Atlanta, well beyond the boundaries of Georgia, well beyond the United States, and that's a good thing. Now, the political part, none of this was political until somebody made it political, and it was shortly after the finding of discernible influence from human activity in 1995, the second IPCC assessment report, that it got the attention of the Koch brothers and folks like that. They had the apparatus for disinformation and misinformation and politicizing the issues and demonizing the scientists from the tobacco wars. And they just followed the same game plan. And it got ugly very, very quickly. And it's been political ever since, and it's been personal ever since. Back then, the guy that wrote the language about discernible influence for the IPCC was identified. He was a public author, and he was Jewish. And crosses were burned on his yard, and his son was kidnapped from Palo Alto and taken to Germany. And the FBI found those people and got his son back. But that's the sort of hardball that people played right from the very beginning.
Yeah, and you really sailed right into my next question, which was about communications, right? We know the power of the media. And we know that communications and the media have the ability to shape and change people's behavior. In your experience, because I know you've been involved in the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Caucus on Climate Change, is that something along the lines that I get the acronym near? Tell us how in your experience have you found it most effective to communicate the issues around climate change to actually change people's behavior?
It depends on the peoples, but it's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's intergovernmental because Ronald Reagan thought it would be a good idea if it weren't attached to, directly to the United Nations. An interesting name to bring up in a favorable light, but we're glad he did that. And the IPCC was created to inform decision makers at the national level. About climate change. They had all signed the Framework Convention, and they thought, well, if we're going to make policy on climate change, we should probably know something about it. So they commissioned this group to every 6 years or so assess the state of the science. And we were communicating to them through summaries for policymakers, and those are the things that were approved by the signatory countries by consensus. In the sense that every word in a summary for policymakers went up before the body assembled of the countries, and anybody who objected to any word could offer a suggestion otherwise. And it takes a week, and you go through 30 pages word for word, and finally you get consensus, which is not to say everybody agrees with everything, it's just to say nobody disagrees with anything. And that was one thing. And then, of course, we communicate with ourselves. But this getting into the political arena without making mistakes and being targeted for misinformation yourself turns out to be really, really hard. About 7 years ago, 6 years ago, now seven friends of mine from IPCC days, so we're all about the same age, and collectively we have about 200 years of experience in climate research and assessment, decided we would start to try to write opinion pieces and thought pieces and fact pieces for the general public. And we were pretty good at getting it into Scientific American and The Hill, and every once in a while The Guardian. But it was very, very, very difficult to do. And we wished, always wished that we had started much, much earlier. And so an encouragement for young scientists as they're moving into this is, yeah, do your science well, focus and devote all of the time that you can do within a balanced life. But also take seriously the responsibility to communicate the so what answer. To the general public. Why are you doing this? You found that. So what? What's in it for me? And you can do that best if you do it together. So create a cohort, pays attention to the news, and meets once a week on the Zoom and talks about what is happening. And oh, we could write about that. That's in our sandbox. And don't think that's a waste of time. That's really one of the pillars of science these days. So we definitely encourage that, and it can be rewarding. The number of publications in the fall of 2025 who will do opinion pieces is diminishing. Scientific American has just decided it will not do any more opinion pieces. My friends and I created a Substack presence in May, and we put something out once a week. Sometimes we repost other things that we find really important. Most of the time, it's stuff that we write, and we write it together. It might come out with a couple of authors. It might come out with seven authors. But we talk about it, and it's always a collaborative process. And I always know more at the end of the hour that turns into 90 minutes than I did walking in, and it's rewarding and I think that's where communication lies. It lies with talking with people like you. It lies with taking advantage of it. It doesn't lie in a lot of social media, because that's vulnerable to people going in and doing nasty things, suing you and saying you're defaming the president and stuff like that.
Yeah, social media is definitely a beast that we're still working through. So I want to back up just a little bit. You said something earlier about the tipping point, and this is a phrase that we've heard associated with climate change so much so that I think also it loses some meaning and context when talking to folks. We had Amy Sharma of Science for Georgia on the show a few months ago. And she was telling us about like several tipping points. It's not just one tipping point. There are several things. Can you just give us a little bit of like an idea of what that tipping point, what does that mean, right? What does the
Right. It means something that happens that has very widespread consequences, impacts, and then consequences that can happen very swiftly and is generally irreversible in humans' lifetime on the planet. So that's a lot of conditions. Losing the Amazon would be one. Melting the methane in the tundra would be one. One I know most about is the instability of the West Antarctic ice sheet. It has been moving towards the oceans at a more rapid pace. It's showing signs of cracking. There are ice columns that are a couple of miles high that are showing signs of disintegrating. Warm water compared to the ice is getting further and further inland underneath it and lubricating the surface of the continent that it's sliding on. And these things are really quite huge. So people thought about them. They're not likely over the next decade, but not improbable. They could happen that fast. They could happen in a couple of decades. They get more likely by the end of the century, but risk management says you worry about that a little bit right now, even if it's very unlikely and if the likelihood can't be quantified. Why is it a tipping point? Well, it's enormous. If it were to collapse, it would probably do so, scientists tell, I'm a consumer of the science, I don't do the science, in a decade and a half and cause a foot to a foot and a half of sea level rise around the globe. So if you imagine Miami and within 10 years, sea level is going to go up a foot. That's an awful lot of damage and not enough time to respond. So that's an enormous consequence, and it happens all over the world. So it's very, very widespread. So that is a classic example of a tipping point. You might want to know how people might take that into account making decisions now. The reason I picked this one is that the city leaders in San Francisco have been worried about protecting their coastline, and there's a lot of it. They wanted the Army Corps of Engineers to analyze a number of futures and six adaptation responses from almost nothing to pulling property back and retreating from the sea and stuff. They looked at three scenarios. One was a low sea level rise scenario, sort of continuing the historical trend. One was a median one from the IPCC report. And the last one, so that's about a foot by 2100, about a foot and a half, 2 feet by 2100. And then one that the IPCC put on is very unlikely, but not improbable, at 6 feet. So what do you do with that? Well, you'd ask the Army Corps to run things on all three of those scenarios with an iterative risk management approach. So you're going to revisit it in 20 years. They divided the coastline, and for most of the coastline, it was economically efficient to assume for the next 20 years that the 2 foot sea level rise scenario is what we were on. And so you do a modest amount and do some planning, build some protection and stuff like that. But for the Embarcadero, the most efficient response economically was to plan as if it's the 6 foot scenario and really be aggressive early. And the lesson was that there, it's cheaper to slow down and let the science or the seas catch up than it is to have to speed up and undo some of the stuff that you already did. So I thought that was really interesting, and it's an example that you can take this stuff into account if you think iteratively in a risk management perspective. And so there's one tipping point that's factoring into decisions that one major city is taking.
And so, that back to that risk management model, adaptation is a huge part of that. Now we know that not all communities are able to adapt in the same way because of, socioeconomic statuses. What are some ways that you think we can make adaptation equitable?
You can make all sorts of lists, but let me answer that question by how do you think about it? Literature that showed up was highlighted in the third and fourth PCC assessment reports talked about the determinants of adaptive capacity. And those include the availability of financial resources to be able to respond to a threat, the availability of something to do. Is there anything that would make a difference? But also the social capital of a community that will get together behind a project that's essentially an insurance policy with benefits in the future. Physical capital, political capital, some people at the top, decision makers that take this seriously and are willing to do that. Those leaders have to be able to, and this would be sort of educational capital, be able to separate signal from noise and describe what's going on to the population in a credible way. So they have to be credible. So it strikes me that adaptive capacity is low if any one of those is low. So you might look at a location and go through that list and see which one is the weakest. And that determines their adaptive capacity. So if they haven't figured out any options, we'll help them figure out some options. If they don't have resources to do some things, help them with resources. If they have a population that doesn't trust the science, help educate that. Help bring in leadership from the top that can speak to their constituents with knowledge about the science and credibility that they aren't providing misinformation, trying to get above the disinformation campaigns that opposing people try to do. It's a lot easier to provide effective disinformation against mitigation than it is against adaptation, because people know a lot more about the consequences for the adaptation where they live than they do about what's going to happen in Sri Lanka.
From your perspective, what balance do we need to strike between like local initiatives to fight climate change and then global initiatives like the Paris Climate Agreement? Because a lot of the work that we do here in Georgia is based on getting Georgia to 100% clean renewable energy by 2050. That's a goal of ours. But we also know that we don't live in a vacuum, right? This is affected by the globe. There are no the lines that separate Georgia from the next state are invisible. So what does that balance look like?
Yeah, that is a great question, a really, really, really hard question. The simple answer is responding to climate risk and climate change is an all hands on deck enterprise. So we need everything, and have to be worried about getting in each other's ways, doing something on mitigation, reducing emissions that makes people more vulnerable. So adaptation has to go up. That's not something you should try to do, but there are a lot of some places where the co-effects are positive, that if you do the adaptation, it's easier to mitigate, or more likely, if you do the mitigation, the adaptation might be easier. You take it all into account. You ask a societal question that applies much more widely than just climate change. One last observation is that any of the policies that improve equity and opportunity for across the population, or education, or housing, or whatever, is something that improves adaptive capacity to climate change. And if you reduce the vulnerability of the community to extreme climate events, that helps bring an increase in social security, personal security, community security, that allows people to focus on other issues that are just as pressing, but have common solutions.
Do you believe that market-based solutions like carbon pricing or green investment are enough to drive the scale of change that's needed? Or do you think stronger regulatory processes are needed?
Good question. The market-based approaches to mitigation are the most efficient and economically. Carefully done, a cap and trade program makes the calculus of what would be an attractive target easier to come by. It's not a giant benefit cost analysis. It is, we want to hold temperature increase to, we can't do 1.5 anymore, but to 2 degrees. Temperature change is related to cumulative emissions of carbon. So that means that emissions this year aren't as important as added emissions over the next 10 or 15 or 20 years. And you're building on a huge amount of cumulative emissions in the atmosphere. So you don't have a lot of wiggle room. But you could, like Europe has done, say, okay, what we want to do is 2 degrees, our share of this is the cumulative emissions that we can assimilate over the next 2 decades. This is our share of it. Let's set up a cap and trade system for 20 years that will allow companies and so on to emit that amount, and they can decide when. They're just going to know that it's an artificially imposed resource constraint. And the market will do the efficiency about that, and maybe come in high, maybe come in low, but that works. So I very much like that. Is it enough in this world, because it's so unlikely that it would become sufficiently ubiquitous? I mean, there's cap and trade in China, there's cap and trade in Europe, but there's not cap and trade in the United States. It's probably not enough. And so within the United States, at least, other mechanisms that aren't as efficient but are potentially politically doable make some sense. Still in the economic perspective, it used to be, until Trump took them away, that the Securities and Exchange Commission required that companies report not only their financial risks to the marketplace, but also their climate risks and climate policy risks. And that allowed companies to require companies to compete with each other for shareholders or for people who want to buy their stocks, taking climate into account. Trump has taken that away, and which is disappointing. But that was a secondary thing that would produce shareholder pressure on the corporations to minimize their climate risk, which is our climate risk.
You've spent decades researching this from all types of angles. Final question. Final two questions, I guess. What's one thing that gives you hope that we can still do something? And what's one thing that keeps you up at night?
Yeah, the hope thing. I think it's really, really important to have hope, and it's really important to understand what that is for an individual human being, or for a community of scientists, or a community of people. I had somebody direct me to some words that Vaclav Havel composed when he was creating the Czech Republic out of nothing. He published it much later, but it was something that motivated him, and he got it. He got his followers motivated by the same thing. I knew this question was coming, so I pulled out his words, and I'd like to read them to you. Because they really apply to me, and I think they can apply to everyone. Hope is definitely not the same thing as optimism. It is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but certainty that something makes sense to do regardless of how it turns out. It is hope above all that gives strength to live and continually try new things. And so I'm not optimistic at this point of progress in the next 3.5 years or 3 years now. I'm very concerned about the things that have been broken and the lack of participation in the US and Paris, and sending nobody to the COP in Brazil this week, and take away the endangerment finding, and all that sort of thing. The things that he's breaking are going to take decades and generations to reproduce. But that doesn't mean there aren't things to do now that make you feel like you're using the talents that have been given you, and the opportunities that you've enjoyed, and the privilege that you've enjoyed, to try to push the boulder in the right direction. So it's that level of hope that encourages me to talk to people like you, and write stuff in Substack. And I think that's really important. There's a whole generation of young people who want to grow up to be scientists, and they're not quite so sure anymore that that's what they want to do. Well, but if that's your passion, let's figure out a way, and let's take the steps on the way now, so that when things change, without guarantee that they will change, you'll be in a position to take over. A lot of my friends and colleagues in the United States are moving to Europe. If you live in Europe, go study under them. Turn our loss into your opportunity. What keeps me up at night is the increasing barrage of attack on scientists, broadly defined, not just climate, and the undermining of the credibility of the scientific method. To the point where you have to worry about something as effective as iterative risk management, because as you change your mind in 15 years, just like they did with Dr. Fauci, they're going to say, "You lied. When you said this and you said this, you lied to us. Now, why should we believe you?" That keeps me up.
Dr. Yo, it has been such a pleasure having you on the show. I could literally talk to you all day about this, but I will save you the time. Thank you so much for joining us on the Greater Greener Georgia podcast, and I truly hope that we will one have you back on the show to talk more about some of these nuances, but that we can also find other ways to get this messaging out there to the public, to the young folks who are interested in being scientists. And I look forward to working with you on that. So thank you again.
Thank you for having me, and you preempted how I was going to close. I'm excited that you all are having success in Georgia, the work that you're doing. If there's anything that I can do to help bring climate to the fore, or communicate, or suggest things that are good to do or good things that are bad to do. Test out a finding. You want to know how credible it is or whether you get attacked. Whatever. Just you know where I live now, so please be in touch.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.